you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. Hope your day is off to a good start. Looks like it's going to be a beautiful, nice and warm day before the rain comes back for the weekend. This is the winter season that doesn't seem to end. And of course, it chooses the weekend to come back and provide rain. We can use it, but be nice to have sunny weekend. Anyway, we're going to be talking later on Air Talk about attendance, particularly in Southern California public school districts, which has declined since the onset of the pandemic, and what districts are trying to do to get students to come back into school and more consistently attend their classes. But we begin with yesterday's audit that found California spent $24 billion over the past 5 years on homelessness, but there was not tracking of that money sufficient that the audit could determine what sort of bang for the buck the state of California received. Joining us to talk about the audit results and what comes next is Marisa Kendall, homelessness reporter for CalMatters. Her piece is titled, California Fails to Track Its Homelessness Spending, Outcomes, Says New Audit. Marisa, thank you very much for being with us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
So we've been waiting for this audit to get a sense of which programs might be giving the, you know, delivering the most services, housing the most people, providing the most mental health or drug treatment, all of those things. Do we have any data that's accounted for at the state that we can make those kinds of judgments here?
Yeah, so we were waiting for answers to all those questions. On a lot of those questions, we're still waiting because the auditor determined three out of the five statewide programs that they analyzed, there wasn't even enough data to determine if they're working. They did determine that one of Newsom's sort of signature programs, the Home Key program that helps cities and counties turn hotels and other buildings into homeless housing, they did determine that is quote unquote likely cost effective.
Okay. And was that based on data that they actually were able to collect on Project Room Key?
Yeah, for Project Home Key, based that on the financials. So they found that it was way more cost effective. The average cost of a unit under Home Key was about $144,000 per unit, compared to building something from scratch would be anywhere from $380,000 to $570,000.
All right.
So they determined that is a good use of the state's money.
Or here in Los Angeles under Measure HHH, I think it's even more than that per unit.
Yeah. Right?
What has been the average cost? Share with us about the California Interagency Council on Homelessness, because they were being looked to provide this data. What does that agency actually do?
Yeah, so they're supposed to sort of spearhead the state's homelessness efforts. You know, there's about 9 different agencies that administer more than 30 programs geared towards homelessness in the state. So it's very unwieldy. The Interagency Council is supposed to sort of coordinate all of that, and they were supposed to track spending and efficiency. They did that once last year using data that stopped in 2021, and they haven't done so since.
We invited someone from the ICH to join us. This is the statement that's been released from the Interagency Council. The state auditor's findings highlight the significant progress made in recent years to address homelessness at the state level, including the completion of a statewide assessment of homelessness programs. But it also underscores a need to continue to hold local governments accountable, who are primarily responsible for implementing these programs and collecting data on outcomes that the state can use to evaluate program effectiveness. The council continues to improve its ability to ensure that taxpayer dollars are spent judiciously and effectively, including by providing technical support to local jurisdictions to help align data standards and reporting. I mean, kind of sounds like, Marisa, that they're saying, you know, the fault is more with local jurisdictions not providing data than with the Interagency Council.
Yeah, that's how I read it as well. And another interesting thing to point out, the council also provided a written response to the auditor's office when the audit came out. And they also, in that response, said they don't have the funding to do, some sort of yearly analysis. They got one-time funds, they did the analysis last year, and they haven't been provided ongoing funding for what it's worth.
Has there been any response, notable response from state legislators to yesterday's release of the audit?
Yeah, there's been the responses have varied. So, one of the assembly members who pushed for the audit is Josh Hoover from Folsom, and he was very critical of the state spending. He said it's frightening the lack of transparency that this audit reveals, and he's pushing for a freeze on additional spending until they can sort of get to the bottom of where the money's going and what programs are working. On the other hand, you have Senator Dave Cortese, a Democrat, and he is saying, now is very much not the time to stop spending. So he has sort of a different take on it.
And is there a concern here beyond determining which programs are working or cost effective and which ones not? Is there concern about the potential of graft here or contracts being awarded under these programs that aren't being properly overseen?
So the audit makes no mention of fraud, and we did ask Senator Cortese that question during a media availability. He addressed that. He said, he was briefed by the auditor's office, and the auditor found no evidence of fraud. But there is just a big lack of data here, so it's possible there are things that are not being reported.
We're talking with CalMatters homelessness reporter Marisa Kendall, who has been closely watching what's happening with this anticipated state auditor's report, which came out yesterday morning while we were on the air on Air Talk. This is the same audit that I mentioned very briefly when we had that breaking news. Now we're digging in a little bit deeper to see what are the implications of the state not having the data available to be able to judge the effectiveness of different types of programs that are being tried. I mean, California, of course, with the nation's worst problem of homelessness, especially visible homelessness, people living on the streets or in their vehicles. And much of the question is when you're trying novel programs, how do we know what works or what doesn't work, or housing an individual, whether it's cost effective at the price that it's actually, taking to provide that housing to the person? In addition to Marisa, we're joined by Doug Chafee, who is Orange County Supervisor representing the 4th District. He's the Vice Chair of the Board of Supervisors and a member of Orange County's Commission to End Homelessness. Supervisor Chafee, thank you for being with us. Your response to the state audit.
Well, thank you so much for allowing me to join you. The state audit doesn't take into account a number of things that we find important. For example, the HomeKey program, that is working well for us, but it's more than just dollars. It helps to reconstruct a neighborhood where we find a dilapidated old motel that sometimes has more daytime customers than nighttime. So it's not just dollars that matter. That is a program, though, when you do compare the dollars, is effective compared to constructing new units. So we like that program. Whatever data is requested by the state, we provide it. So it's not a shortage here. We do look at things in our own programs differently. We don't wait to the end of the line to figure out whether it's effective. Even an example, we recently started in my district an emergency rental assistance program. It's in its third month. I'm already finding I need to make some changes there. We can provide up to 3 months of rental assistance to people who are at risk of homelessness, and two more if we work through our healthcare provider, Cal Optima. But we're finding that it's more staff intensive than I thought. We need some staffing to make it work. We're also finding some good news. Some people only need 1 month to get back on their feet. So we're in there hands-on. We're not waiting to the end of the day to figure out what works, what doesn't work. We'll make adjustments as needed, as we want these programs to actually work.
How do you staff for that? Because it sounds like, and Marissa, maybe you can weigh in on this if I'm mischaracterizing it, but it sounds like in some of the counties, they've not deployed people to do the kind of oversight, to process the kind of feedback that you're talking about with the rental assistance program or others. And so, Supervisor Chafee, is that your sense that in some of the counties, they're busy spending money on homelessness, but they didn't allocate anything for review?
Well, we have ongoing oversight. For example, there are federally mandated semi-annual point-in-time counts. We did one in between. We didn't wait because we thought additional data would be helpful to evaluate what we're doing. And we found some interesting things when we did that. We asked more questions. One of the interesting questions that was not asked during the federal point-in-time count was, where did you sleep last night? That gave us amazing data. We test things not only on the financial end, but on the people that we intend to help. Is it working? Is it getting to the needs that you need? And what else can we do that's missing? What can we do better? We want to be out in the field doing a people audit as well. And as a result of that audit, our CEO called the department heads in, and we had an all-day session examining what we're doing and trying to make things better. So it's ongoing with us. We don't wait.
We're talking with Orange County Supervisor Doug Chafee, also with us, Marisa Kendall, homelessness reporter for Cal Matters. Marisa, does this get into, or the Intergovernmental Council statement, you know, get into what we're seeing from counties and cities in terms of how they're tracking this?
Yeah, so the audit also focused on two cities, San Jose and San Diego. So in terms of, you know, local efforts, it was really limited to those two cities. San Diego did provide a written response to the audit saying that it has hired additional people to do oversight. So San Jose and San Diego both said they have new methods and new measures that they're getting online to try to address some of these problems.
We have listener Jack in Los Angeles who raises the issue about Proposition 1, which was narrowly passed by California voters. And he says, you know, if this audit had been released a bit earlier, would Proposition 1 have still passed? Because, of course, it would have given additional leverage to opponents of Prop 1 that the dollars wouldn't necessarily be properly tracked from that major bond issue. Marisa, can you speak to the timing of the release of this?
Yeah, that's an interesting point. You know, this audit initially was expected to be released back in October 2023. Then it was supposed to be released earlier this month. And then they pushed it back and it was released yesterday. I think it is possible that would have given detractors from Prop 1 more ammunition. You know, as we know, it was a much closer vote than I think a lot of people, including the governor, anticipated.
So what comes next, Marisa, with the interagency council, with the state trying to collect this information? Do we know next steps?
Yeah, so the audit laid out a bunch of recommendations for the state, for San Jose, and for San Diego that it wants to see implemented by September. You know, things like just creating some sort of centralized place to account for spending and beefing up accountability and metrics tracking. The audit doesn't really have any teeth to force those recommendations to happen. But some of the legislators, including Assemblymember Hoover, have said they are hoping to introduce some bills this session that would have more teeth and that would force some more of those accountability measures.
Thank you so much, Marisa. We appreciate it very much, you joining us and sharing with us the latest. We'll look forward to talking with you again soon.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Marisa Kendall, our partner, Cal Matters. She's homelessness reporter. And our thanks as well to Orange County 4th District Supervisor Doug Chafee. He's vice chairman of the board, member of the county's commission to end homelessness, his district including much of north and part of central Orange County. Want to remind you that we have a brand new AirTalk weekly newsletter that launches this week. And it gives me an opportunity to very directly share with you some of the exciting things we have going on with AirTalk, to get your feedback on segments, to highlight some of the ones I thought were most interesting that you might have missed as you went about your day. So please sign up. Of course, it's free. And you can sign up for AirTalk Weekly, the newsletter in which I have a chance to connect with you directly by going to laist.com/AirTalk. You'll see it right there. Please enter your email address and we'll make sure it's in your inbox every week. That's the brand new newsletter, AirTalk Weekly, launching this Friday. It's AirTalk on LAist 89.3. Coming up, we're going to be taking a look at all the homeowners who are losing their insurance in the wake of State Farm's refusal to write some new policies and to cancel some current ones. We'll talk about that when we come back in just 1 minute.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle, and I sure hope to see you at Dodger Stadium. It's our second annual Dodger Stadium night for LAist members. We look forward to seeing you there. LAist night is Friday, June 21st. And it's perfect because it's a Southern California matchup between the Dodgers and the Angels. Your donation for LAist night at Dodger Stadium includes two lodge-level tickets. Remember, of course, your contribution keeps AirTalk and all our other programming and reporting going strong here at LAist 89.3. But we would love to see you. Tickets are very limited. Last year, they sold out quickly. We've got the same number this year, so they're going to go fast. But I'd love to see you Friday, June 21st, Dodgers versus the Angels. It's LAist night at Dodger Stadium. I'll be there along with All Things Considered Nick Roman, and we hope to meet you there. Took a lot of photos last year when we did this. It was so much fun, and if you were there last year, you probably want to come this year, but get your tickets early. We want to make sure that you don't miss out. Well, the State Farm Insurance Company has canceled, or not renewed, I should say, over 70,000 policies in California. And some communities have been hit particularly hard. Los Angeles's west side and some of the areas around the hills have been hit very hard. State Farm has said it's not going to be renewing throughout California policies for 30,000 homes and 42,000 apartments. Joining us is Los Angeles Times staff writer Ruben Vives, who has been reporting on this. Ruben, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
What are some of the communities that seem to have had the highest number of non-renewals on those State Farm policies?
Yeah, when we looked at the recent filings by State Farm, we saw that in Pacific Palisades, basically 69% of the policyholders, and that's about 2,342 customers there, would be impacted, would essentially lose their coverage. In Brentwood, we saw 61% of 2,114 customers there will lose their policies. That's about 1,300 non-renewals there. And we also saw similar percentage of losses in Woodland Hills, in Bel Air, and, you know, obviously in other parts of the state as well.
How are the homeowners associations, because I know they're very tight and influential in those communities, how have they responded to this?
I mean, they're in a panic mode right now, is my sense of what I've gotten so far from some of the associations that I've spoken to. I've spoken to the Brentwood Homeowners Association, which has about 1,200 members, which they own about 4,000 properties. And they're freaking out. I think the main thing is they were sort of seeing the writing on the wall that this could possibly happen. But what is really shocking to them is that it's also impacting residents who are living near or along some of the high-risk fire zones.
State Farm, one of the biggest insurers in California historically. You talked with State Assembly Member Jackie Irwin, who her district is heavily affected by this. What did she say about the potential for legislative action to help here?
Yeah, well, she's hoping that the state will move with urgency and will try to resolve some of the regulations that are preventing some of the insurance to get back into the writing policies back in the state. And these are regulations that basically have sort of slowed the process in how much rates can be these companies can sort of ask for. It usually has to go through a process through the state. And it usually takes a very long time. So she's hoping that these new regulations will speed up the process, will allow these companies to be able to start sort of charging the rates that they think will allow them to be able to keep up with the capital gains to address some of the potential losses whenever there's a wildfire or major flooding that happens out here in the state.
Even with the current level of regulation, my sense just anecdotally is for people who haven't seen non-renewals of their policies, they've seen some big increases in the annual rate of their insurance, as insurers have been hit so hard, of course, by California's wildfires. There is an insurer of last resort if people can't get it otherwise. That's the California FAIR Plan. Ruben, to what extent is the FAIR Plan able to accommodate thousands more people?
Well, I mean, it's supposed to be the FAIR Plan is basically this pool of insurance for residents who can't find fire insurance coverage. It's supposed to be a last resort, but it has sort of become sort of the go-to insurance coverage right now, and it's seeing its exposure to liability losses increase. I think it was 300 billion as of 2023, and that's up from 50 billion in 2018. And they only have a surplus of 200 million. That is certainly very, very alarming because if there is a catastrophe such as wildfires, and we are around the corner from fire season in terms of the summer, that's going to be a big problem.
Ruben, thank you so much. Really appreciate you sharing the reporting you've done here on this for the Los Angeles Times and highlighting these zip codes in Los Angeles that have been particularly hard hit with non-renewals of those State Farm homeowners policies. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ruben Vives, staff writer for the Los Angeles Times. I'd like to hear from you if you're someone who has had a policy not renewed, if you've had a very high percentage increase in the premium of your homeowner's insurance, if you've had policies canceled. I'd be interested in hearing from you. We're at 866-893-5722, 866-893-5722. You can also post your question or comment on our AirTalk page at las.com/airtalk, and you can email us at atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and first name. With us is the former State Insurance Commissioner of California. He served two terms, 2011 to 2018, Dave Jones, who is currently at UC Berkeley Law, where he's director of the Climate Risk Initiative at the Center for Law, Energy, and the Environment. Thank you so much, Dave Jones, for joining us again on Air Talk. We appreciate it.
Great to be with you this morning.
So, what can the state do to respond to this? And, insurers saying that they cannot afford to continue providing coverage under the rate restrictions California set.
So, what the commissioner is proposing is basically to allow insurance companies to raise their rates faster. And that might help in the short or midterm to encourage insurers to renew more policies and to start writing new insurance again. But the challenge is the real driver of this crisis is climate change. It's the underlying risk of severe catastrophic wildfires driven by the climate crisis that is driving the inability of insurers to renew or write new insurance. And at some point, and Florida is exactly at this point now, frankly, we may approach a point where even at higher rates, the underlying risk associated with climate change is so great that insurers conclude they just can't renew or write insurance in high wildfire risk areas. Now, there are some things we can do. One is more aggressively and comprehensively reduce our reliance on fossil fuels. California's been a leader on that. There's things insurers could do. They are collectively investing about $569 billion in the fossil fuel industry, just U.S. insurers alone, and they need to transition out of those investments as a part of our transition away from supporting fossil fuels. But second, one of the big drivers of the problem in California is forests choked with fuel, and that's as a result of 150 years of wildfire suppression and genocide against Native American peoples that used to do cultural burning. So we know now that if we actually do controlled fire and thinning of forests, it can make a dramatic difference in the reduction of wildfire risk. And the state has appropriated $3.6 billion for that. Homeowners associations are paying for that. Local governments are paying for that. The problem is that the insurers' underwriting models, the models they use to account for whether they decide to write or renew insurance, don't account for that forest treatment that we're all paying for. That needs to change. And that's why State Senators Josh Becker and State Senator Bill Dodd have introduced Senate Bill 1060, which would require the models that the insurers use to make these decisions, whether to write or renew insurance, to account for forest treatment. So, again, focusing on the underlying risk drivers is what we need to do in the long term to get us out of this mess.
That's a very long term. People over the next few years, of course, are going to be dealing with either the inability or the unaffordability of homeowners insurance. Lance in Santa Monica, I understand you've been a State Farm customer for three decades.
Yes, that's right, Larry, and a very loyal customer. I'm a very big proponent of State Farm until my agent told me, as he happened to pull up my case file, that indeed I was being canceled. And it's disconcerting because I have been such a loyal customer and a big proponent of State Farm recommending it to any number of other people, which, of course, I will no longer do.
Lance, thank you for sharing that. You were among so many people, and we're hearing from them now on Air Talk. Robin, in the Hollywood Hills, understand you've been a Travelers Insurance customer?
Yes, just like your previous caller, we were for like 18 years a Travelers customer. Last year, they doubled our premium, and then this year, they sent us a notice of discontinuance, and they predicated this upon the fact that they said, the risk in your area is rated from 1 to 30, and you are designated a 3. And I thought, a 3? And after you've doubled our rates for a year and collected, it was just appalling to me.
Well, I think of the Hollywood Hills as fairly high fire risk. That not the case with your property?
No. I mean, it's been, I believe you lived in Beechwood Canyon for
yeah.
a time. And
yeah, I grew up there.
Up in that area. And there was a serious fire here, but it was back in the 60s. There hasn't been anything since.
Yeah, the advantage of Beechwood, it's such a wide canyon, which has been seemingly very helpful, knock on wood, when it comes to fires. Robin, thank you so much. I appreciate it. 866-893-5722. You can also email us at atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and first name. David in Ojai said, my insurance has been canceled. They demanded I cut down all the trees on my property, and I just won't do that. I'm thinking of putting sprinklers on the roof. Might be just as cost effective. David, I'm so sorry to hear about that. And Dave Jones, this is something that we've heard about from our listeners, that insurers are getting very demanding about cutting down trees on property that they consider to be fire risk. But, for many homeowners, they may live in areas where there are tree ordinances protecting trees, or, they've invested years in cultivating those trees and don't want to cut them down. Maybe they trim them to try and control fire risk, but insurers are telling them it's not enough. Is there any recourse for homeowners in that circumstance?
So it is the case that there's a lot of empirical evidence that defensible space, which includes removing vegetation within some proximity to the structure, not having any attached structures attached to the structure, and then hardening one's home makes a big difference. And insurers are reacting to all of that evidence. And so, yes, more homeowners are going to have to do things that they don't really want to do if they want to keep their insurance. But in addition, there's some things insurers can do. And I mentioned SB 1060. That would help not only in the long term, but also in the short term. With that bill enacted, insurance models would immediately begin to have to account for the billions of dollars in forest treatment, defensible space, and home hardening that's being invested. And that's critically important to make sure that consumers are given a fighting chance as we're making those investments to have that reflected in the models that are being used to decide whether to write them or renew them insurance.
Julianne emailed us, we just received a letter from Liberty Mutual that our homeowners' policies won't be renewed. We live in Joshua Tree and have two rentals in Yucca Mesa. That's Julianne. Michael in Santa Monica says, I live away from the flood zones and fire zones, but my homeowners' insurance premiums have gone up 70%. Susan in Village Green in Southwest LA says, our condominium was canceled by State Farm. Our insurance rate went up 5 times for insuring the community overall. It's causing issues with us here. Susan, I would bet. John in Santa Monica, I had a 45% premium increase from Mercury, had to refinance my home to pay $22,000 to replace my roof after they said it was outdated and needing replacement. It's a slap in the face after I spent money at their direction only to see a 45% increase. And Peter in Silver Lake says, I'm bundled with home and auto, 2 homes and 3 cars. My insurance has gone up dramatically. Each house has gone up $800 this year alone. My insurance agent warned me not to be late on payments, otherwise they won't reissue my policy. That's Peter in Silver Lake. Dave Jones, we have a listener who's asked, what happens if the state insurer of last resort, the California FAIR Plan, goes broke?
So the way that the FAIR Plan is set up is that it's not required like a insurance company to have reserves sufficient to cover major catastrophic events. Instead, the FAIR Plan is an involuntary association of insurance companies established by state law, and they have enough reserves to cover average years, but if they were to have a series of catastrophes and go through those reserves, then they have the right to surcharge all the insurers based on their market share. Now, this is one of the reasons why State Farm has paused writing new insurance and is non-renewed, because as they were renewing policies, all their brothers and sisters in the insurance industry were non-renewing. So State Farm's market share grew to 21%, which means they would be on the hook for 21% of any FAIR Plan shortfall. So they looked at that and decided, gee, that's just too much exposure, and so decided to begin non-renewing policies, policies that, again, many of the other insurance companies would have non-renewed some time ago. So that's how these two things are connected. Having said that, there are some things that the legislature could authorize for the FAIR Plan, for example, authorizing the FAIR Plan to sell catastrophe bonds as a way of raising more capital so that it would reduce the likelihood that they would have to surcharge individual insurance companies. That's something that the legislature has allowed the California Earthquake Authority to do for earthquake insurance as a way of reducing their reinsurance costs.
Gilbert in Encino, and we're tight on time, but this is a great question. It says, to get a mortgage to purchase a home, you need insurance. But if there's a lack of homeowners insurance available, what are potential homeowners supposed to do?
So insurers are the canary in the coal mine with regard to the climate crisis, but it has ripple effects not only through the insurance industry, but like your caller has said, potentially into real estate markets and potentially into lending markets. And yes, if you can't get insurance, then you're going to have a hard time getting a mortgage, particularly a federally backed mortgage where insurance is required. This also raises implications for people's ability to keep paying their mortgage, because as their insurance costs go up, it challenges their ability to pay their mortgages. Many mortgages are sold by mortgage lenders into the secondary market, which is Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac ought to be paying attention to the possibility of more defaults as people are getting hit with higher and higher insurance costs. So it's a crisis, and I keep coming back to it's climate change driving it, and it's forests choked with fuel. On the forest choked with fuel, we know what we can do about that, more funding for forest treatment, but also making sure by passing SB 1060 that the insurance models account for those investments and they give people the benefit in the insurance model risk score of the investments we're making in reducing wildfire risk in those forests.
Dave Jones, thank you very much. Appreciate you being with us and sharing your thoughts and analysis of this homeowners insurance problem that Californians are facing. Is it just, it's getting bigger year by year. Thanks so much.
Always a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you. He's the former California Insurance Commissioner in office from 2011 to 2018, Dave Jones. He's at UC Berkeley Law, where he directs the Climate Risk Initiative. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. Coming up, we'll talk about the new book, Tripped, Nazi Germany, the CIA, and the Dawn of the Psychedelic Age. Author Norman Ohler, New York Times bestselling author, is with us. We'll be back in just 90 seconds.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. So good to have you with us. Norman Ohler is author of Trip, Nazi Germany, the CIA, and the Dawn of the Psychedelic Age. It's a follow-up to his book, Blitzed. Norman, thank you so much for joining us today. So what links did Nazi Germany have to LSD and to hallucinogenic substances?
First of all, I'm also thank you for having me. It's great to talk about these things. The early history of psychedelics, that is what interested me in Tripped. And I wondered, why did LSD not become a normal medicine? Because, research was very hopeful in the beginning, and I could trace the Nazi past of this substance, which was very surprising to me that there was one, because we always associate LSD as the hippie drug or as the love drug. But actually, there were occurrences back then in the mid-40s that I found in the archive of the company who made LSD. Their CEO at the time was best friends with a leading biochemist of Hitler. They had the best friends actually since the 20s, with a German scientist and a Swiss scientist that they had always swapped knowledge. And so the Swiss CEO also told the German guy in 43 about LSD, this most potent substance that works on the human mind, that was known to man back then and is known to man now. Sanders didn't really know what to do with it, what it was, because this was like before all the antidepressants and all the mental, all the pills for the mind were conceived. LSD was like the first one. So he consulted with this buddy of his who was living in Heidelberg. He said, I've been researching with this, and we found this now. The buddy, his name was Richard Kuhn. He actually was responsible for developing a truth drug for Hitler, which the CEO from Switzerland didn't know. So he became very interested, and the Nazis set up psychedelic research at the concentration camp of Dachau. They actually gave prisoners LSD and mescaline without telling them, and then, tried to develop meaner interrogation techniques that could extract all the secrets from a person that's, under the influence of a psychedelic without knowing it. So this is kind of, in a way, this is unknown research, and when the Americans liberated the Dachau camp, they became interested in it because they were interested in the scientific advances that Germany had, which, the German scientists were like leading in the world. The Americans were very curious. And when they heard from Richard Kuhn in Heidelberg in the spring of 45 that, the Nazis had been interested in LSD and psychedelic molecules, the American military became very interested in it. And that's kind of why then Sandoz, the company, was not able to put it on the market as a medicine after the war, because after the American military, the American intelligence services, CIA, became very interested in it, because then they thought LSD could be a weapon and could be utilized in the Cold War against the Soviet Union. So CIA tried to get kind of a grip on LSD and prevented it from becoming this normal medicine that might help people with mental diseases.
What was the CIA thinking would be the usefulness of psychedelics like LSD during the Cold War?
Well, the SS had done these experiments in Dachau, and the reports were sent by the American military to a professor at Harvard. His name was Beecher. He had been the drug consultant of the American army before, and then he evaluated what the SS did, and his reports were then being sent to Sidney Gottlieb, who was freshly working in the CIA, setting up this program around LSD, around the possible truth drug. Basically, they thought that they could use it as a weapon in a way to maybe even humanize the way war was being led. Like they were entertaining ideas like, would it be possible to spike the water supply of a Soviet battleship with LSD? And with LSD, you wouldn't kill the soldiers. They would just be tripping, basically, but they would be unable to operate in a professional manner, because on high LSD, like especially a group of people high on LSD, cannot function in the proper sense anymore. Like they do different things. So this was one thought they entertained. And they were afraid that the Soviets were using LSD as a weapon, which they never tried. They never tried this in Moscow, but in Washington there was fear, so they wanted to, they set their own people under the influence of LSD to see how would they react if suddenly, like, the Russians slipped them LSD into a drink, for example. Would you reveal all your secrets? So from all kinds of angles, the CIA was now examining LSD as a potential weapon, as a potential tool for mind control.
But Norman, what archives did you access to get this information?
The most important archive is the archive of Novartis, which is one of the biggest pharmaceutical companies. They swallowed Sandoz, the inventor of LSD, in the 90s. And so all the papers are in Basel, Switzerland. I spent quite a bit of time there. And it wasn't actually easy, because everyone who examines LSD always looks at the papers of Albert Hofmann, the actual chemist who discovered it. And obviously, it's interesting how a normal Swiss chemist suddenly, by chance, discovers the most potent hallucinogenic psychedelic molecule that exists on the planet. It's an interesting story, but what is more interesting are actually the papers of his superior, of the CEO. His name was Stoll, and his friendship to the Nazi scientists. I found that after spending days in the archive trying to figure out what's actually there to be found, and brainstorming together with the archivist, who was helpful. So this archive was very important, but also the national archives in the United States were important, and other archives, like in Berlin, the archives of this physicist who was trying to develop it as a truth drug. So I traveled quite a bit to research this book, but that's fun. I love to be in archives. It's fun to discover something in these old, papers that suddenly are in front of you.
We're talking with Norman Ohler, author of Trip, Nazi Germany, the CIA, and the Dawn of the Psychedelic Age. We'll continue our conversation with him when we come back in just 1 minute on Air Talk. Coming up next hour on Air Talk, we're going to look at the ongoing problem of high rates of absenteeism in California public schools. This is a huge issue because schools are funded by the state based on how many students show up every day to class. It's not the overall enrollment, it's however many are actually at their desks each day. We'll be talking about what the implications are and what districts are trying to do to attract students back to school with absentee rates so high, and the implications, obviously, for student learning high as well. Right now, we're talking with Norman Ohler, the author of Tripped, Nazi Germany, the CIA, and the Dawn of the Psychedelic Age. At what point, Norman, does LSD become considered so dangerous that it needs to be banned?
It's interesting, because when the Swiss company developed it, they created a tripping room within the company. They didn't call it a tripping room, but that's basically what it was. And all the employees went there and received LSD and told the secretary, who was typing it all up, like what they were experiencing, and no one was experiencing any dangerous no one had any problems. People were they were happier than they usually were. They were looking outside the window and were connecting with nature. So LSD didn't seem to have any negative effects. It only had negative effects once the CIA started using it on people without telling them, and also the Nazis. That's what the Nazis did. Then LSD has a deeply disturbing effect because you know suddenly changes in your brain happen. What is interesting is that when the CIA was unable to actually turn LSD into a weapon, because it just never really worked. I mean, you can make someone insecure with it, but you can never like really control someone's mind just because you put that person under LSD. So CIA realized it's not working. And at the same time, LSD became more and more popular because the CIA was also spreading it. That's why John Lennon once said, we have to thank the CIA. They gave us LSD, because this MKUltra program was involving more and more American citizens, giving them LSD unwittingly or wittingly. And suddenly the guinea pigs, as Ken Kesey, a writer, also received LSD for the first time from the CIA, said, the revolt of the guinea pigs happened. More and more people, especially in the 60s in America, took LSD. And then more and more people who were in the anti-Vietnam War movement took LSD. And then President Nixon decided that LSD should be a class one substance in order to be able to attack basically or control the peace movement. So the LSD was never made illegal because it's dangerous. Like, there were never any clinical findings that it shouldn't be used, but it was considered dangerous to the establishment, and therefore it was illegalized, and therefore the other research which also always had happened of psychiatrists trying to figure out how it can help in the brain, it was stopped in 67, and it lay dormant until the early 90s, when in Switzerland a professor for the first time again clinically looked at what actually LSD does in the brain. Is it actually dangerous or is it not? And he found that it basically, when the brain is on LSD, he did brain scans with people on LSD, so he could see very clearly like how the energy flow was in the brain, and the ego of each person who is on LSD gets less energy, while other parts of the brain start communicating stronger than they do before, because before they are like under the control of the ego. So during a trip, actually what happens in the brain is that the brain reorganizes itself differently. Now, this is called neuroplasticity. Neuroplasticity is the ability of the brain to kind of reorganize itself all the time. The brain is not a rigid thing in our heads. It's a fluid thing. It always reconnects and kind of looks at how the outside world, what tasks it has to do, it kind of reorganizes itself. Yeah. Also, he realized it's anti-inflammatory, and now science has proven that inflammatory processes in the brain lead to dementia. So it actually seems now that LSD is not only not dangerous, but actually quite healthy. So we have to realize now our anti-drug laws in this case are not based on scientific findings, but on ideological, they have an ideological basis. So that's why we're changing now our view on these substances, basically.
We're talking with Norman Ohler, author of Trip, Nazi Germany, the CIA, and the Dawn of the Psychedelic Age. I certainly didn't know him well, but I interviewed Timothy Leary, and so I certainly had a sense of him later in his life. And I always wondered what effect LSD had on him, because in his later years, I don't know that it was LSD or not, but certainly he seemed to be somewhat disconnected in his later years in the conversations that I had with him on air. I'm old enough also, Norman, that when I was an elementary school student in the 60s, we were actually shown these scare films about drugs, including that LSD could put you on a bad trip and cause you to do terrible things, to harm others or to do self-harm if you were having a bad trip, as it was described with LSD. This was part of typical anti-drug education in California schools, Norman.
Yes, I mean, LSD is a potent substance, and certainly there's dangers connected with that potent substance, just like there are dangers with other substances. But certainly what what we are being taught about LSD and other psychedelic medicines is propaganda, anti-drug propaganda, which is not based on scientific findings. So I think it's quite important to educate ourselves if we are interested in these substances. And the, I mean, we did it, for example, in our family, because my mother suffers from Alzheimer, and I read studies that LSD stimulates the very same receptors that Alzheimer degenerates. So we had a discussion in the family, and we decided to try microdose LSD against the Alzheimer disease with actually great effect. So I think it's very important to try to figure out what actually is the truth, or where you can find, you know, more detailed information on these, what I think are actually medicines that help with problems like dementia or depression, where other medications do not really help.
And of course, this would have to be studied in a controlled, clinically devised test, so that you would really determine whether LSD has that sort of benefit or not. Norman, thank you for joining us and talking about your book. We appreciate it very much.
That's Thanks Norman. A lot. It was great being.
Thank you. Okay. Norman Ohler is author of Trip, Nazi Germany, the CIA, and the Dawn of the Psychedelic Age. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. Coming up in our second hour, we'll talk about a terrific new exhibition at the Peterson Museum. I went out and saw it last week. Also talk about absenteeism, which is really vexing California public schools. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3.
Earlier this month, Rose Cerna received a letter in the mail.
Your tenancy is being terminated by reason of the fact
the journalists of LAist work for you.
I'm LAist senior housing reporter David Wagner. I help Southern Californians, including renters and landlords, navigate the region's affordable housing crisis. And I help you stay on top of the ever-changing renter protections and housing policies.
LAist, independent journalism, fact-based journalism.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up later this hour, a new exhibition at the Peterson Automotive Museum, Eyes on the Road, which looks at the art of the roadway as well as created works that pay homage to the automobile and transportation generally. But we begin with an issue we've talked about many times since the onset of the pandemic here on Air Talk. That issue was chronic absenteeism in California public school districts. The New York Times recently published a piece in which it quantified absenteeism across the country and showed many states are having similar problems to what we're having right here in California. The Times piece estimates just over a quarter of public school students nationally were chronically absent last year. The big challenge, of course, schools and districts trying to find a solution. Here in California, it's a particularly acute problem because the funding that schools get are based on what's called average daily attendance. That is, how many students show up on a given day at the school site. We begin our look at chronic absenteeism in public schools with KCAL News anchor and senior reporter Ross Palumbo. Ross has a new investigative piece focused on LAUSD attendance, and it begins with a math teacher at an LAUSD school. The teacher is also a candidate for the school board. Ross, so good to have you with us. Ross, you there? All right, we'll try and get Ross back with us. Ross Palumbo of KCAL News will soon be announcing a partnership with KCAL. Yeah, Ross, we got you. Yeah, you're on the air, Ross.
Good morning, Larry.
Hi, good morning. Yeah, so share
with you. The school we're talking about here is Madison Middle School in Valley Glen. And as you say, it was a math teacher that made this allegation of attendance fraud. What he says happened was after the day of culmination of last year. That's basically the graduation day for eighth graders. That happened on a Thursday, but their last day of class was actually on Friday. And he says, of course, because they just culminated, none of these eighth graders showed up to class. So he marked them all as absent. And then he says he got a call from the office telling him to mark them as present. So the surprising thing here, Larry, is that he sent a letter to the principal saying that he was uncomfortable with that. And the principal, he claims, emailed back saying, quote, this is how the district deals with culmination. Now, the problem, as you just laid out a few seconds ago, is that this is how schools in California are funded. Kids being in class on a day makes a difference. So on average, the state tells us that one child per day in school averages about $111 of funding. So for that one day, if there were no eighth graders present at that school at Madison Middle, that would have been more than $51,000 in funding for that one day. And this math teacher is blowing the whistle because he says that's wrong. That's money that that school simply should not have gotten.
Now, your coda to the story was that the state said that that average daily attendance only goes through a date in April. So for the last day of the school year, this wouldn't have financial implications. But of course, the allegation that the school is falsifying attendance, a serious allegation nonetheless.
Definitely. And, you know, when you really look into how they calculate this average daily attendance, they calculate from the first day of class to April. So then they use that number and they pay for all of the 180 days, including the last day. So even though there is a technical reason that this last day is not included in the average, what the teacher's point is, we are still paying the school for that day. He believes it's a technicality, and he does believe there's wrongdoing. But above and beyond that, the bigger issue may be, for many people, the ethical problem with them allegedly lying on the attendance. And the issue of, you're a parent, and the school is saying your child is there. Is your child there? Where's the responsibility there as well? And if the school is doing it on this day, his allegation as well is, what other days are they doing this on? He believes this is a problem, not just on this one day, but going back for years and costing taxpayers millions upon millions of dollars. LAUSD would not sit down and speak with us about this and would not answer our questions directly, even though we had been trying for 4 months, but they sent me a statement saying that they have investigated and they determined that this was an isolated incident. They do not believe it's a widespread problem. But Larry, we had requested the attendance records to verify what they are saying, and they have not released those records yet. And they have given us no information about what kind of investigation they've done here, how they verified this. I did speak with the auditing agency for the state, and they tell me that the school has not requested an extensive audit here, and they believe that's what would be needed to completely assure parents and taxpayers that that money is being properly requested and funded for the schools.
We're talking with Ross Palumbo, anchor and senior reporter at KCAL News. We're talking about Ross's investigative piece, which debuted last night, about this allegation from Dan Chang, a math student, math teacher, LA Unified, that he was directed to falsely fill out an attendance form when students were actually not in class on the last day of the session. Tony Thurman, superintendent of public instruction, also talked with Ross, and he said he was going to look into this, Ross.
He did. And, you know, the reason we went to the state superintendent, who is over all of the local superintendents, is because LAUSD superintendent Alberto Carvalho refused our repeated request to speak with him about this. The state superintendent, Tony Thurman, who's also running for governor, said that he had not heard of this, that he would look into this, and that he would look into whether an audit was necessary. Once LAUSD said that they conducted an investigation, the state superintendent said that he is comfortable with that, and at this point, he doesn't believe that a larger audit is necessary. But critics of the district point out that this is really the fox guarding the hen house here, that the school district, which is accused of attendance fraud, says that it investigated itself and that is currently the end of it. So, you know, we're leaving it to viewers to decide whether the local superintendent, Alberto Carvalho, or the county superintendent should really request a full audit from the state to really find out what's going on here.
Ross, thank you for joining us and talking about this issue. This is certainly a piece of this larger issue of concerns about absenteeism in LA Unified and other California public school districts. Thanks for talking about your reporting. We appreciate it.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Ross Palumbo of KCAL News, anchor and senior reporter, talking about his investigative piece. I'd like to hear from you now. If you are a parent, if you are a teacher, if you have any connection with school districts here in Southern California that are suffering a significant problem with no-show students in class, give us a call about what you're seeing in your district and what you think are the reasons at play. I think one of the big challenges here is understanding why, because it definitely seems since the onset of the pandemic that even after the end of the pandemic, once schools returned to in-person classes, we didn't see the same levels of attendance of students that we saw pre-pandemic. And I think for professional educators and administrators and policymakers in education, they're all trying to figure out, why is that? Is this a change of mentality on the part of parents and teachers? Is it that school is not the same degree of priority that it was pre-pandemic? Is it that families are traveling during the school year in a way that they weren't pre-pandemic? I'd like to hear from you what you think is going on with schools. We're at 866-893-5722, 866-893-5722. You can email us at atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and first name. Also, you can post your comment or your question on our AirTalk page, las.com/airtalk. We had lined up to join us LA County Superintendent of Schools, Deborah Duardo, who was scheduled to join us. But in the last hour before air, we were told she needed to drop out of the conversation. So unfortunately, Superintendent Duardo will not be joining us, but we're very pleased to have with us Policy Director on K-12 Education at the Public Policy Institute of California, Laura Hill. Laura, thank you for being with us. Please quantify how big a difference this is post-pandemic from what we saw in attendance pre-pandemic.
Well, thank you for having me this morning. And it definitely has been a big change pre-pandemic to post-pandemic. The last year, pre-pandemic, the 2018-19 school year, about 12% of students were chronically absent. And these are students who are missing about 10% or more of the school year. That's about 18 days. And that can be for any reason, excused or unexcused. So pre-pandemic, we were at about 12%. Then the first year we could measure it, it rose to a kind of shocking 30% of students were chronically absent. And then this last school year, the 22-23 school year, it came down somewhat to 25%, which is still double the pre-pandemic rate.
And where are we seeing the bigger rates or the bigger growth in absenteeism, older kids or younger ones?
It's been uniform, but the most sort of shocking growth was really among the students, so kindergarten students in particular. This rate went from, I think, gosh, what was it before the pandemic? I can't remember exactly, but now it's something like 36% in this most recent year, and it was as high as 40% last year. But prior to the pandemic, I think most people thought of the chronic absenteeism being kind of a truancy problem in high school. And that still is a big place where we see chronic absences mattering and being a high percentage. But really the biggest uptake was in the kindergarten grade level.
You know, I've been hearing anecdotally from some teachers in Southern California districts, in districts that have significant numbers of students whose families had immigrated to the United States, that because of travel restrictions during COVID or concerns about traveling, that some of the families have been traveling during the school year, kind of catching up on connecting with family members abroad. But now we're so far out from people starting to travel again, it wouldn't seem that would necessarily be an issue. So, Laura, do we think that is any part of this?
I'm sure that some degree of travel kind of up and down the kind of the income spectrum. It could be families who are saying, like, during COVID, we were working remotely and were able to take a vacation and it didn't matter where we were, and families who are trying to reconnect with family members that are in other parts of the country or even in other countries. I'm sure that did happen to some extent, but that's surely not all of it. I think that the districts that are having some successes or working to connect with families are, you know, going to their homes, and they are, in many cases, the children are there. So it's certainly not the case that all of our chronic absences are due to increases in travel.
We're talking with Laura Hill, K-12 Policy Director, Public Policy Institute of California, and I'd like to, we'll try and get those notifications turned off as soon as we can, but I'd love to hear from you as a listener to AIR Talk, what you've experienced with your local school district. Are you seeing significant increase in absenteeism? If you're a parent and your kids have gone to school less frequently post-pandemic than they did pre-pandemic, I'd be interested in hearing the reasons why. We're at 866-893-5722. If you have any ideas for how schools and districts could increase attendance, obviously they don't want kids, you know, with contagious illness coming to school, but, you know, kids have been coming to school with sniffles and things like that from time immemorial. 866-893-5722, or you can email us at atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and first name. Trudy in Burbank says, one of my kids is an LAUSD teacher, and she says, I think the pandemic has made parents comparatively indifferent to attendance. Trudy, I appreciate that. Laura Hill, I know that's difficult to quantify, but I wonder if there's been an attitudinal difference. You said, you know, more parents are working from home in many cases than in the past. So the idea of going to an office or work site in some families is not the same as it was. Do you think that that's trickled down to students?
That's a really hard question to answer. I don't, in the data that we're looking at, we're not quite able to parse that. But I do think that I've certainly read reporting that there's little less connection between families and schools, and that, you know, this extended period of being remote for instruction may have really made a difference to how families feel about their schools. And when you're talking about kindergarten, that, you know, some of these families are brand new to the system in the first place. So they may not just have established that pattern of, you know, needing to be in school and understanding what it takes to get families and children to school every day. Certainly the New York Times story that you referenced mentioned families who were, you know, if the parent was unable to backfill if the kid missed the bus, then that child is home for the day. I think that there's a range of reasons that families are not getting their children to school in the same number that they were. And I do think the health issue that you mentioned is not insignificant. There's still some uncertainty about when it's okay to send your child to school.
Well, we'll continue with Laura Hill, K-12 Policy Director, Public Policy Institute of California. We have some listener calls we're going to take from Angie in Pasadena, Mia in the West Adams District of Los Angeles. I'll share a comment from Adam in South Los Angeles. All coming up, we're at 866-893-5722. You can email us at atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and first name. And I really want to hear from you. If you're a parent, if you're an educator, an administrator, what are you seeing in the district with which you have contact? And what do you think are the reasons behind it? What can schools and districts do to try and get those kids back into the classroom? We'll be back in a minute. It's AIR Talk on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. We're talking about the serious problem getting students to stay in class and not be home and absent post-pandemic. Public districts throughout California and across the country, as documented in a recent New York Times piece, is a big issue. California is particularly big because of the way the funding structure works. Average daily attendance is taken. Schools are compensated. They are funded based on how many students are attending on a given day. Let's talk with Angie in Pasadena. Angie, good to have you with us. What have you observed with your two school-age kids?
Sure. Thanks, Larry. So a couple issues as a parent of a first grader and a fourth grader. I actually feel that, one, as parents, we've probably become a little bit more lackadaisical, but I also have seen in this kind of post-pandemic world that since our kids went through the pandemic and they spent most of, you know, the latter half of kindergarten, first grade, and some of second grade essentially online, they simply just don't have the immunity. And they've been getting sicker. Both my kids last year and this year probably have over 15 absent days, and we're getting nasty grams from the district, and I understand it, but they get sicker for longer. And, you know, that's definitely a challenge. But I also have seen, you know, these kids face something that we've never faced, where they had everything ripped away from them, and there's a lot of anxiety. And I think that plays into it, too, where they either, you know, might be anxious about going to school if there's a big test, or they ask to come home early if they're having a really bad day or facing bullying. And luckily here in Sierra Madre District, they've actually implemented like a calm room and hired a person with emotional support capabilities to help students who are facing this type of thing. So, you know, we're working through it, but we're definitely challenged by it as well.
Yeah. Now, do you send your kids to school if they're not feverish, but they're still clearing out? Maybe they got a runny nose, because schools have said, you know, your kids don't have to be totally symptom free to send them back. We don't want them contagious, but you know, if they've got the sniffles, send them to school. So, what do you do as a parent?
Well, as a parent, I work from home as well, so I get way less done if they're home. So I try to send them to school as often as possible, plus yeah, they need to learn. But, you know, like, you know, I really do gauge it. They're pretty good kids. They tell me, hey, Mom, I really don't feel good. I really can't go to school.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Yeah.
Respect their energy level and what they're able to do, and if they're able to focus in the classroom. Good point. Angie, thank you so much. I appreciate it. Angie in Pasadena. Mia in the West Adams District, good to have you with us. Your question or your thought?
Yes. Why are we still, why have we not reconsidered payment of schools the payment model? Why are we encouraging students to go to school sick? Why is this the only way that schools can get paid? As a result, students are arriving to school, throwing up, sneezing, and making the whole community both physically ill. And so I don't understand why we still use the ADA model, especially post-COVID. That's my first question. And my second question is, of the students that are not returning to school, you asked the question about elementary versus high school, and I want to ask the question versus gen ed versus special needs children, because there are 67,000 students with special needs, and I can say that there was a catastrophic failure to provide services and support for those students during COVID, and a lot of those students have not returned. And so I'd be curious to know how many of those.
That's interesting. I'd be curious about that, Mia, whether there was a return or not. In the Glendale district, where my wife works as a speech pathologist, they continued providing services online to the students. She continued with her caseload with students, and their numbers have been very solid post-pandemic. I know that's not been the case necessarily with all districts. Laura Hill of the Public Policy Institute of California. Let's start with the second question first. Do we have any stats about the return of special needs students?
I don't have those off the top of my head. I do know there has been, you know, some understanding to try to understand which of the students have not returned. And certainly there are students who, you know, they've moved to different systems or they've moved out of state. We can't explain all of our decline in enrollment with those kinds of things. There's also a decline in birth rate that helps us understand why we have fewer students now than we did before the pandemic. But there are some students who haven't returned. And then separately, the question of are chronic absences higher among special education students who have returned to the system? I think that they are indeed higher than they were prior to the pandemic, as they are for all students.
Now, her question is, why do we still use this formula? We don't want kids who are, you know, contagious coming to school. She mentioned, you know, throwing up or you know, sneezing and potentially exposing other students and personnel at the school to that. Have there been serious proposals for alternative ways of funding schools aside from ADA?
Yes, indeed. There are other states that fund using enrollment, and there have been conversations in the past in California, and probably will be again, about using an enrollment rather than an ADA measure. I mean, I think, you know, just to be clear, I don't think schools are encouraging students who are contagious to come to school. So I don't think,
yeah,
you know,
that's right.
The ADA does not want to incentivize people to do that.
No, I think the challenge in switching from the ADA model, I'd be interested in your thoughts on this, Laura, but you want to incentivize schools for you know, being attractive enough that families are having their kids come to school. And some districts will have enrollment figures that have never really been as high percentage attendance as other districts, because perhaps family members travel for their jobs. They work in agriculture or other, where the students are not necessarily in the same district all year long. So then pegging the funding to that, when you have students that might be more in transit, that could have an effect on other districts. So I wonder, I mean, it would seem to me there are trade-offs, whatever model you use.
For sure. And, you know, the districts that have the largest chronic absenteeism problems, you may not want to punish them and make it harder for them to retain the students and bring them back in. So there are lots of trade-offs to consider between the two. But I think that one thing, taking a global, like a broader look, you see that chronic absenteeism has really skyrocketed across the United States, and that includes states that are based on an enrollment model.
Adam in South Los Angeles says, I've been running mentoring mental health programs for a few years in Los Angeles. We just haven't seen the investment, even pre-COVID, in the program. So we're seeing the result of that in school absences, Adam attributing it to mental health challenges. Ed in Venice says, my son has a lot of illnesses and has had absences because of it. The pandemic has also made us more aware of illness in general. Yeah, and of course, As Laura Hill just said, districts are not encouraging that parents send communicable kids to school. You don't want to have illness running rampant through your school site with other students, because, of course, that has a negative effect on ADA if kids are contagious and spreading their illness to other students. And, of course, you don't want your teachers out because there's a shortage of qualified substitutes in most public school districts. So that's a challenge, too. But at the same time, you don't want all kids with sniffles staying home. Jess in Huntington Beach says, I've been a teacher for over 20 years. I think that there's been a paradigm shift. Kids are more independent. They're finding information for themselves on the internet. They can learn their own way. That's Jess in Huntington Beach. That's interesting. So a bunch of autodidacts are what we're seeing. That would be interesting to study, Jess, if that is actually the case. Erin in Hawthorne says, I taught for 17 years. I'm a mother of two elementary school age kids. I quit teaching because kids have become addicted to their phones post-pandemic. I felt like I was wasting my time trying to teach. Administrators didn't seem to care. I think districts need to focus on screen time. Chad in Echo Park says, we would never fund any other business like this. This is a deliberate attempt to undermine education. Chad, I don't know about, I mean, this has been a longstanding way of funding schools in California. And Laura Hill, California isn't the only district to fund ADA, correct?
That's right.
Yeah, so I don't understand how it would be set up to undermine education. I certainly understand it's a challenge for districts now. Julie in Glendale says, my biggest concern is about the schools thinking about the money involved in this rather than the students. And Julie, that's an excellent point. Laura Hill, the districts are also concerned about students falling further and further behind if they're not in the classroom. And please elaborate on their concerns about that.
Oh, certainly. I think, you know, right now we're still, the districts are still very much trying to recover from the learning losses that took place during the pandemic. And when we're, the kinds of things that we're talking about to remedy include summer school. And if you think about how many days summer school is, that's really about the same number of days that chronically absent students are missing. So if we've got a bunch of students that are missing at least 18 days of school, we are not going to come back from the pandemic anytime soon without a lot more investments. And schools are highly motivated around trying to improve these things. The test scores are things that schools schools and districts are publishing, and we have to keep track of how they're faring to understand if there are improvements being made. They are motivated, I think, but they really struggle if students aren't in the classroom. It makes it harder for students, for teachers to make progress with the students that are there. And it can create, research has shown, a sense of contagion where the more students that are absent, the more likely present students will be absent in the future.
Shay and Duarte says, I'm a school psychologist. My experience is working mostly with students with disabilities. I see a lot of attendance issues with students who have siblings who also have disabilities, and parents often struggling with providing care or getting services at home for all their children, leading to their reliance on older siblings to provide some of that care. I think the pandemic has a big negative effect on the availability of some of those in home services, at home services, and now we're seeing that impact schools as a result. That's Shay in Duarte. That's a very interesting analysis, Shay. Thank you so much. Let's see. We also have Angie and Downey. My son started transitional kindergarten this school year, and he's been out 11 times already. It's not purposeful. I send him to Saturday school to make up absences when I can, but he's just sick so often. I don't send him when he has a fever or vomiting, for example. If it's sniffles or cough, which seems like always, I do send him. I brought this up during countless doctor visits, and I often hear that after the pandemic, colds or minor illnesses have more severe symptoms due to a lack of immunity because the kids were quarantined for so long. Great comments from listeners. Thank you so much. Bill in El Segundo, we have children in kindergarten, third, and fifth. Since the pandemic, we realized the daily attendance isn't required to receive the same level of education. So if we have a special event or an opportunity to travel, we'll pull the kids out of school and do independent study. Also, we pull our children out if they have a temperature over 100 degrees. Other parents seem to send their kids to school continually, spreading flu and the common cold. Before the pandemic, we were, quote, 100% attendance required parents. That's Bill in El Segundo. This is just fascinating. So much great input from listeners. Laura Hill of the Public Policy Institute of California, K-12 Policy Director, thank you so much for being with us. I feel like during the course of this, I've really learned a lot from parents and from teachers who've shared their experiences. I hope that's true for you as well.
Indeed. Thanks for including me.
Thank you. Laura Hill, PPIC, joining us on Air Talk. Coming up, we're going to turn our attention to Eyes on the Road, a new exhibition at the Peterson Automotive Museum of Los Angeles. I had a chance to see it last week. It's wonderful. We'll talk with the curator of it and the director of the Peterson when we come back in 1 minute on Air Talk.
Hey, it's Brian, the host of How to LA, a podcast that is a love letter to Los Angeles. Independent movie theaters are having a glow-up moment.
Vidiot's and Eagle Rock, amazing. We have our friends at the American Cinematheque. The Vista just reopened.
In our new series, Revival House, we'll take you inside these spots and share their history. Because movie history is LA history. Listen to Revival House on How to LA wherever you listen to podcasts.
I was just going through some of my photos that I took at the exhibition Eyes on the Road when I visited it last week at the Peterson Automotive Museum in Los Angeles along Museum Row. Just so many great images that show the kinds of visuals from the very beginning of the automobile and the construction of national trails highway across the U.S. Everything from directional signs and explanations about what those signs mean to then images created by artists to celebrate the automobile or provide social commentary on traveling by car. We're very pleased to have with us the guest curator of the exhibition Eyes on the Road, Jim Farber, who did the wonderful Route 66, The Road and the Romance exhibition. He helped curate that back at the Autry a decade ago. And also with us, the executive director of the Peterson Automotive Museum, a man who's been with us multiple times on Air Talk, Terry Cargis. Terry and Jim, good to have you both with us today.
Good to be here.
Appreciate it. Jim, let me start with you, because you actually pitched the idea to Terry for doing this. What was your notion behind this exhibition?
The basic idea that it started from grew out of Route 66. The Route 66 show was seen as an historical overview of the history of the road, and it incorporated art, but it didn't focus on art as a statement unto itself. And I thought that was an aspect that needed to be explored more. So Eyes on the Road grew out of the idea that we are surrounded by invisible art. And one of the primary tenets of the pop art movement was to draw focus to things we take for granted: Brillo boxes, Spam cans, in the case of Ed Ruscha, standard stations, and then with the idea of adapting that to the mandate of the Peterson, which is cars. But with a car goes nowhere without a road. A road needs signs. It needs an infrastructure. And when you put all that together, that became Eyes on the Road.
We're talking with Jim Farber, the guest curator of the exhibition. Terry, so this is kind of a co-creation, because you and your staff doing much of this exhibition and Jim collaborating. Share with us sort of how this grew and the conception of it, what you decided to include in it.
I think what really happened was that once you start to study the idea of art on the road, art from the road, art around the road, it becomes obvious how expansive this is. I mean, everywhere you go there, especially in Southern California, and Southern California is an art-filled roadway and highway, freeway. And what really became obvious was that with Ed Ruscha, Bob Gurr from Disney, the famous, just one of the legends, truly. We were talking about that earlier. He's an icon. But all of the things that came together because of especially Southern California car culture and the number of roads and the varying things, that then you take a looking into it, how are we going to put this together? Well, then AAA, their contribution is enormous.
Their archives are something else, I understand.
And they've been wonderful in helping us. And that is it, Morgan. Morgan, you need to do this story in Westways. This is a wonderful, wonderful exhibit. It's really inspiring to come in and see all of this put together and be reminded about driving down the road and seeing what's around you.
Often I'm going through an exhibition before it's open to the public on a press day or something like that. This time, Jim took me through it last week after it was already, it was one of the early, maybe second day it was open. And to see everybody responding to it, people loved it. I mean, it was, and they're, you know, trying to hang on Jim's every word as he's describing it to me. And to see it through their eyes, too, because I was totally into it. I'm a geek for this kind of stuff. But to see the general public come through and how captivated they were by this was very exciting. I wonder, too, about... because this does many things. It has cars as well as a part of it. So how did you choose the actual cars that you wanted to highlight as a part of an exhibition about art in plain sight on the road?
Like all of our galleries and all of our specific exhibits, there's a topic. And so this is broken up into five different sections. So the cars that are in the exhibit, the Dymaxion is in the Buckminster Fuller.
Oh, that's wild.
Which is one of those, is it really a car? I mean, is it functional? Yeah, but right. But is it a Bucky Fuller? The 55 Ghia Streamline, Gilda, the Rita Hayworth nickname, the Chevrolet 69 Chevrolet Astro, the Astronome, the 56 Astronome. And these were things that were, this is a collaborative, what we do is collaborative with our whole team and certainly with Jim. And then as we started to talk to other collectors, here's what the possibilities are. Here are some of the things that can come together. That's one of the exciting parts about what we have been able to do over time in the museum is work with a number of people from all different walks. But what's the story? How do we tell that story? And like I say, there's five different sections to the exhibit.
Well, I love the Gyron from 1961. You've got on the wall Incredible Sid Mead, the great artist, his work, which looks like a futuristic cocktail party around this car. And Jim described, because so much of what's on the Gyron are stuff that you know we now have in automobiles.
When this show was in its formative stage, there was sort of a buy-in for me, and that was it was going to have cars in it. And I thought, all right, if that's what I need to do, we'll figure out a way to do that. Then the idea evolved, why not do cars that were never meant to be produced? They were a concept. They were an artist's vision. And the first car that I absolutely fell in love with was the Ford Gyron. It was cast from fiberglass. It was delta wing shaped. It had an onboard gyroscope. It was a two-wheel car with sort of outward struts. And it was all electric. It did not have a dashboard. It had a screen that could tell you theoretically how far it was to your next destination. And I swear this is true, in the brochure material published when they unveiled the car, it said, we believe in the future this car will be interfaceable with cellular phone technology.
In 1961.
Yeah, it was a Tesla. It was a Tesla generation before Tesla. But I have to tell you the story of the Astronome. The trouble is, on radio, I can't show you what it looks like. But if you can imagine if the Jetsons ever owned a car, it would be the Astronome. The problem was we knew it existed, but I didn't know where. So I went through a whole research process, and I actually found it 7 miles from the Peterson on Laurel Canyon Boulevard in the valley in a little shop called Metropolitan Pit Stop. And they have been generous enough to loan it. And it is, if you're going to fall in love with a car, it's going to be the Astronome. It is so impractical and wonderful. And
it's based on the old Metropolitan.
Well, that's what it's built on,
the
frame of it.
Yeah.
But from that point on, it is a total fantasy. And the promotional photograph, they actually use the background from Forbidden Planet. And this woman with her suitcases and her Astronome, it's like she's going to work on Forbidden Planet. And it's you just have to see that.
Well,
and
I'm guessing this is on Instagram in the few days since this has been open, because in the short time that in the hour that I was there going through the exhibition, there were so many people doing selfies in front of that car. Mm-hmm. It was clearly very popular.
It was mentioned that if you fell in love with a car or how you fell in love with a car, one of the original Autopia cars from Disneyland is there. And in fact, Bob Gurr, who designed it, signed it, which was a real treat for us.
I won't ask you what you think of it going all electric, but I'll spare you that.
Next question.
Yeah, right. We're talking with Terry Gargas, joining us, the executive director of the Peterson Automotive Museum in Los Angeles. Jim Farber is the guest curator of Eyes on the Road, the exhibition that we're talking about. We'll continue, and hopefully we have a little time for Terry to tell us about some other stuff that's up there at the Peterson right now. We'll be back in just 1 minute. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. Larry Mantle talking about the Peterson Automotive Museum's Eyes on the Road exhibition. The art that has been in plain sight on the road since the beginning of the automobile, and the art that artists have created, either through vehicles themselves or their visual art depicting our relationship with the automobile. Jim Farber, the guest curator of the exhibition, Terry Karg is the executive director. director of the Peterson with us. Jim, you have a portion of the exhibit that highlights the first, I believe she was civil engineer in California to be licensed, working with the State Department of Highways on freeway construction.
Her name was Marilyn Jorgensen Reese. And one of the things I discovered when I was doing the research for the exhibit, we wanted to incorporate the idea of the freeways. It was an important element, and it's such a key to the landscape of Los Angeles. And in that research, I discovered that there were a group of women who had been part of the Caltrans organization who played a key role in designing those early freeways. If you ever saw the movie Hidden Figures, these were the equivalent with Caltrans. They were doing cutting-edge engineering, and they received very little credit. In the show, and one of the pieces that was amazingly difficult to get, but it's wonderful, is an original model from Caltrans of the proposed interchange of the 105-110 freeway. But that engineering begins with these women. And I just wanted to make that point in the show. And we have a picture of Reese at the construction site, who is beautifully dressed and not exactly in overalls and boots and everything else, because she had to maintain her image as a 1950s woman of style. But it's a point that I just wanted to make in the exhibit because people don't know about it. The other part of it is that when you drive that interchange, you may see it differently now, because you'll know that it was designed by a woman, or you'll think of it. And this show does that all the way through. It's about vision. It's about looking at things you take for granted and then suddenly seeing them in a different context.
And of course, you mentioned Ed Ruscha earlier, his Standard Station, and of course the influence of that work. There's a portion of the exhibition, Terry, that's devoted to, you know, getting gasoline, and there's a gorgeous pump that's there as well. And I don't recall. I think it was Shell, and so the pump is designed with sort of a Shell motif, absolutely gorgeous to pump your gas out of.
That section is called At the Pump, The Art of the Gas Station, and it's images and symbols of gas stations from an artist's perspective. There's Warhol, Ruscha, Vic Muniz, and others. It's really quite spectacular. I mean, it captures, like you say, the artist's interpretation of this is what you see. And it's very simple art, but it's a great story.
But the gas station pump itself is remarkable. It sits on a Corinthian column. It has sculptured light fixtures. And, of course, it's glass, the part that actually held the gasoline. It is gorgeous. But the point was that it was a piece of functional art. Mm-hmm. No one, you know, probably pulled into the gas station to pump their 10 gallons of gas was going, oh, my God, that's certainly a beautiful gas pump.
Yeah, and why are the prices now 25 cents a gallon? What is that?
That's a beautiful thing to see, too. The other, you have a photo of an Anaheim gasoline station maybe it was around the time Disneyland opened, late 50s, I guess. I'm trying to recall when that was, but you just see how inviting the gas station was made, anything but strictly utilitarian, yeah. Jim.
It's a beautiful photograph. It was actually taken by Julia Shulman, who was sort of the Ansel Adams of architecture. And he did a number of color images as well. That actually is from the Getty collection. And the mobile station was in Anaheim, but it has a wonderful mid-century modern sense of elegance. The woman in the foreground is driving a Jaguar, and there's a T-Bird that's parked at the pump. And this unusual Pegasus, which is at the top of the gas station, is an Art Deco style. I've never actually seen it before or since. But it's a wonderful photograph, which we've blown up. And throughout the show there are these large graphics that really help the show, and they put these pieces in context.
Yeah, and I was sharing with you, I went through it. I remember There was one of the mobile station Pegasus that was neon, and the Pegasus would sort of light up at the in the night. And it was in the Crenshaw district of Los Angeles. I drive by it all the time as a kid and loved seeing it. And this was an era where the canopies of gas stations were not just the sort of utilitarian, just cover the pups. They were sweeping awnings, Terry. That these were terrific architecture.
It's like the art of that in a show that Jim had done years before at Route 66. What motels and diners became, you know, real art forms, some kitsch, but largely very, very fascinating. And I mean, it was the kind of thing that the idea was it's going to catch your eye, and it did.
So when you go to the Peterson to see Eyes on the Road, the new exhibition we're talking about, Terry, just quickly, a couple of other things you've got in the galleries at the Peterson that people can see when they go.
We're just about to open the, which will be our most expansive and biggest effort on lowriders. We'll have 32 lowriders from around the world. We're bringing two over from Japan, but the LA community and the folks in that at lowrider community have been very supportive, and Denise Sandoval from Northridge, a PhD in Latino studies, has been instrumental in all of our exhibits on the lowriders. But this will be something quite special.
And what is the link with Japan? Because I've heard about this too, that there's significant lowrider culture in Japan.
They have had custom enthusiasts over there for quite some time. This is the first that I'm really learning about a lowrider population over there. But these are two absolutely remarkable. There's nothing like them anywhere. And that's why, hence, bring them from Japan. That's great expense, I might add.
Well, a lot of what you do is, I'm sure, a great expense. When you're transporting vehicles, I was asking Jim about this. The care that you have to do, particularly with long-distance shipping of vehicles.
We don't allow any vehicle to be moved alone. Any time any vehicle is going to be moved, there are more than one that you have to have somebody guiding you, watching. I just got a report the other day that last month alone we moved 572 cars in and around the museum.
Wow!
In exhibits, out of exhibits,
loaning them
shows.
Elsewhere.
Yeah.
Wow! And that doesn't take into account the insurance, of course, for transporting vehicles.
Well, as an example, 7 years ago, someone got careless with a lowrider as they were loading it into a truck to go back to its owner. He wasn't paying attention, and it swiped the side of the truck. You don't want to know the bill.
I don't. Joe in West Hollywood says, I'm a civil engineer. The 105-110 interchange is absolutely mind-blowing, he says. Joe, thank you for that. Eyes on the Road, Jim Farber, guest curator of that. Terry Cargas is the executive director of the Peterson Automotive Museum. So you just heard a couple of very good reasons to go visit the Peterson. Thank you so much for joining us. Stay tuned. NPR's Here and Now comes up next. Have a wonderful rest of your day.
The stakes to save the Colorado River are high.
So if there's no water, there's no water for everybody.
California and six other states on the river must reach a compromise, but they're divided. The fate of the river may come down to a 28-year-old.
This is a historic thing coming.
The people and the real human drama behind the historic negotiations. Listen to Imperfect Paradise, the Gen Z water deal maker, wherever you get podcasts.